is to be real. I think compensation for our bereaved family must be completed.
South Korea's Supreme Court last December ruled in favor of the victims of the Gochang massacre, suggesting the state may be responsible for the killings. Lee Sung-yul is lobbying the National Assembly to pass a law outlining redress.
The court found that the victims were killed by the armed forces, so the Gochang massacre should be compensated even more than other similar incidents in South Korea. That was the ruling of the Supreme Court at the end of last year. The Gochang massacre must be compensated by the state.
The Gochang massacre represents just one episode of South Korea's often painful and forgotten past. But the divisions laid bare here remain, as survivors seek compensation and understanding from their nation. Frank Smith, Gochang, South Korea.
A ceremony in the Afghan capital Kabul has marked the 44th anniversary of Iran's Islamic Revolution, bringing together officials from Afghanistan's Taliban ruling system, as well as foreign diplomats representing various countries. In the event, Shir Mohammad Abbasi Stanekzai, the deputy foreign minister of Afghanistan, stressed that Iran's 1979 revolution was an Islamic and popular movement.
Our neighbor and friend Iran today celebrates a movement that 44 years ago led to the foundation of an Islamic government in Iran under the leadership of late Imam Khomeini. A positive point of this revolution is that it achieved victory in a short period.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran also had an impact on other nations, especially those that had been oppressed, and inspired them to stand against tyranny.
Following the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the issue of imperialism turned into world arrogance, oppression, and justice. This Islamic viewpoint didn't remain limited to Islamic countries. Even today, you see movements against world arrogance in Latin America. It was right after the Islamic Revolution that plots of the adversaries started to fail. I can refer to the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and Iraq that happened to be big failures for the U.S.
ما پیروزیمون وقتی است که دست این اجانب
Shortly after Iran's Islamic Revolution, Afghanistan was also invaded by the Soviet Union. In those years, the Iranian Revolution inspired people here to stand against the invaders.
Afghanistan might be the country that was inspired the most by the revolution, especially in the early years following its victory. The fight against the Soviet forces in Afghanistan became more serious at that time, and it eventually led to the eviction of the Soviet Union from Afghanistan.
44 years after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, more and more countries commemorate their revolution and this spirit of standing against tyranny. The Islamic Revolution of Iran 44 years ago was the beginning of a trend that in Afghanistan inspired people to expel then Soviet Union. Dullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
The National Media Association in Lebanon held a gathering in the capital Beirut to show solidarity with the Syrian people who continue to suffer because of the U.S. sanctions imposed under the so-called Caesar Act. The journalists, media figures, politicians, and representatives of the resistance front noted that Syria stood with the resistance groups when the world had abandoned Palestine and Lebanon, and that now is the time to stand with Syria.
From Beirut, the National Media Association announces the Beirut Declaration and calls on the Arab and Islamic people and the free people in the world to work on confronting oppression and stopping the wars of sanctions and famine, which are against basic human rights.
The U.S. State Department has claimed that the sanctions do not target humanitarian aid, but Monday's earthquake has proven the opposite.
It's a mere maneuver by the United States just to confront this wave of indictment to the United States, and it's a way for them to reimpose the sanctions in order to achieve their geopolitical agenda. I believe that we need to keep pressuring
the United States, exerting pressure, moral and material pressure, in order to lift the sanctions of Syria.
Over 3,000 people have so far died as a result of the catastrophic earthquake in Syria, as rescue teams continue to search for survivors under the rubble of the buildings, which have been completely leveled to the ground. In addition to rescue efforts, the Syrian people are in dire need of essentials like medicine and fuel, which have not been allowed to enter Syria because of the Western sanctions.
They cannot still like turn around sending humanitarian aids to Syria through NGOs or others. It should be through the governments of Syria. After all, the government is doing all the necessary job to help people and to take them to hospitals or to make shelters or so.
On February 6th, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, killing thousands in the two countries. While countries like Iran and Russia have sent aid to Syria, the amount of humanitarian assistance that reached the Arab country is still very little compared to the international aid sent to Turkey.
At least five rescue teams from Lebanon headed directly to Syria to provide all the assistance they can of the rescue efforts, yet many are saying the aid that many are providing is not enough. Participants here today stressed that the U.S. and its Western allies need to lift the unjust sanctions against Syria and the Syrian people. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
More than 1,700 guests attended the National Day reception in the center of Moscow, hosted by the Iranian embassy, to mark the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The reception was attended by top Russian dignitaries, as well as military figures and members of the civil society. Non-Russian diplomats could also be seen at the event.
And basing on objective analysis, I am absolutely sure that now our Russian people with Iranian people should fight together against the great enemy, our common enemy, understanding together each other better and better, as well on the spiritual level.
The prominent philosopher says he predicted that modern Iran and Russia would grow closer years ago. They share the same values, interests, and both belong to the ancient Eurasian civilization. They also seek to bring an end to years of Western dominance and oppression across the globe.
Iran is truly one of a kind in this world. It has one of the most ancient civilizations, and it continues to live up to that legacy. Despite heavy sanctions and pressure, they have made astonishing achievements in the past four decades. People are high-spirited. Iranians yearn for development. I'm very glad that the relations between Iran and Russia are flourishing. Together we can solve many problems in West Asia and around the world.
According to Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak, in the last year alone, trade with Iran and Russia has reached $5 billion. The position of the two countries is in tune with a number of international agendas. The two nations oppose the model of a unipolar device and will do everything to defend their sovereignty.
Iran is an example of a harmonious combination of the principles of religion, human rights, and national interests. We maintain a high intensity of political and economic dialogue between our countries. Russian-Iranian cooperation is reaching a qualitatively new strategic level, despite the illegal pressure of unfriendly countries.
The guests of the reception all believed in one thing. The stability of Iran's Islamic Revolution is due to the unquestioning support of people. Iranians are defending their revolution despite constant propaganda, as well as huge funds to overthrow its results.
The anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is commemorated in Russia every year. As the two countries continue to expand ties, Russian political elite pay their respect to Iran. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iranians from different walks of life have participated in the commemoration rally from all parts of the metropolitan Tehran to the iconic Azadi Square to mark and celebrate the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and renew allegiance with the ideals of the revolution.
The Iranian nation toppled the US-backed Pahlavi regime 44 years ago, ending 2,500 years of monarchy in the country. The Islamic Revolution led by Imam Khomeini established a new political system based on Islamic values and democracy.
The celebration was held in Tehran and over 1,400 cities and 38,000 villages around the Islamic country.
We are here to support our country, and we are here to tell the U.S. to back off so that we can make more improvements in our country. We're going to support this government, this country forever. We're going to support our supreme leader. So you just have to stop interfering in our affairs. And we want to say that down with the U.S. because you've been the cruelest country in the world.
We celebrate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution to show the world that despite all riots and plots hatched by the enemies, our Islamic Revolution is strong and powerful. We love our leader and the Islamic Revolution and are ready to sacrifice our life for the ideals of our revolution.
Addressing crowds of people at Azad Square, Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, said West's policy of imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation.
West's policy imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation. The United States and its allies failed to stop the Iranians from making progress. The Iranians managed to make the enemies' plots futile. The West, the U.S. in particular, stands accused of human rights violations by waging wars in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The West must be held accountable for its crimes in the region.
The demonstrators underline the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country. Analysts believe that after 44 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic establishment, Iran has now been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom seekers and the oppressed nations of the world. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting 270 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects, to take part in the 13th Ahwaz Oil Show. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are on the list of U.S. sanctions.
We have invited all of the local companies operating in oil well services, instrumentation, and the production of any equipment that's required in the oil and gas industry. They are here to achieve synergy with each other and state-owned firms with the ultimate goal of increasing our oil production.
For decades, Iran relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery from drilling bits to pipelines.
After almost 110 years of dependence on the import of drilling bits, our engineers at Asmari, along with other Iranian firms, have been able to indigenize the bit technology. So we design and manufacture a range of drilling bits locally, and this is thanks to the restrictions caused by sanctions.
With regard to sour service pipes, our company used to import them for its oil-related projects. We didn't need to reinvent the wheel, but after Trump imposed sanctions on Iran in 2018, we put our heads together and managed to produce our own anti-corrosion pipelines.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Following the U.S. reimposition of sanctions against Iran in 2018, Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs. That's why the government in Iran is now making a seismic shift to local manufacturers to rebuild its oil sector, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
About seven decades ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector, something which experts here describe as another turning point in the oil industry. This would shield the country's economy from the impacts of oil embargoes. Yusuf Jalali, Ahvaz.
In
line with a fourth meeting of Iran and Russia media cooperation, a delegation of Russian television executives, as well as TV and radio station managers, led by the Russian Deputy Minister of Digital Affairs, visited the IRIB World Service's TV and radio stations. That included the Spanish channel Hispan TV and the English news network Press TV, a chance for the Russian delegation to observe the technical developments up close.
Both the Russian and the Iranian side have reached a point where they are ready for practical steps after holding several rounds of meetings and signing cooperation agreements. We have laid the groundwork, and our audience will soon be enjoying our joint TV and radio productions.
The visit also provided the opportunity to discuss potential areas of cooperation.
We can cooperate in exchange of content. It's movies, TV series, it's cartoons and documentaries. There is a very broad field.
The details were carefully discussed in order to break down the steps and see how the two sides can take cooperation to the next level. First and foremost, representatives were appointed from both sides to be directly in touch and to be in charge of joint media productions from now on.
Iran and Russia are both under pressure and sanctions by Western countries, so this meeting and the one we had 2 days ago are of strategic importance. There is great potential, and I believe that we can immediately begin joint radio production.
But the highlight of this meeting was how to neutralize Western sanctions, particularly in the field of media, with the Iranian side sharing its valuable experiences in this regard.
We are witnessing a new world order, and under these circumstances, regional and international powers such as Russia, Iran, and China will be growing closer and develop stronger alliances. Russians are experiencing sanctions aimed at isolating them since the war in Ukraine has begun. We can share years of experience with them in this regard. Our media cooperation not only allows unheard voices to be heard, but it will also reshape public opinion.
Both sides agree that the groundwork is prepared and joint production can start in 2023, marking the beginning of a strategic alliance in a multipolar world where all voices can be heard. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
In the limelight.
The Pentagon has said a United States fighter aircraft downed a Chinese balloon off the coast of South Carolina amid worsening Sino-US relations. Beijing blasted the Pentagon's decision to shoot down the alleged Chinese spy balloon, charging the United States with clearly overreacting and seriously violating international practice. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website of CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed new sanctions on China, targeting the country's several companies for supporting Beijing's military modernization efforts. The U.S. Commerce Department said on Friday, 10th of February, it added five Chinese companies and one research institute connected to Beijing's aerospace programs, including airships and balloons, to an export blacklist. The Commerce Department claimed the six entities were supporting China's military modernization efforts, especially the People's Liberation Army's aerospace programs, including airships and balloons. The six companies, including Beijing Nanjiang Aerospace Technology Company, China Electronics Technology Group, and 48th Research Institute, and the Dongguan Linkong Remote Sensing Technology Company. The other three are Eaglesmen Aviation Science and Technology Group, Gangzhou Tianhai Xiang Aviation Technology Company, along with Shaanxi Eaglesmen Aviation Science and Technology Group. The move came a day after the U.S. Congress unanimously condemned China's alleged use of what it called a spy balloon that flew over North America recently. China said it was a weather balloon. The balloon was shot down by a highly advanced U.S. fighter jet recently. President Joe Biden congratulated U.S. fighter pilots for taking down the balloon in the country's airspace and above its territorial waters. China has expressed regret, blaming unfavorable winds for pushing the civilian airship into U.S. airspace. Beijing insists the balloon was a civilian airship used for research, mainly meteorological purposes, and it unintentionally veered off into U.S. airspace. Companies added to the so-called entity list are restricted from acquiring U.S. items and technologies without government authorization. Undersecretary of Commerce for Industry and Security, Alan Estevez, in a statement on Friday said, "The People's Republic of China's use of high-altitude balloons violates our sovereignty and threatens U.S. national security. Today's action makes clear that entities that seek to harm U.S. national security and sovereignty will be cut off from accessing U.S. technologies." The Commerce Department alleged in a document that China's military is utilizing high-altitude balloons for intelligence and reconnaissance activities, adding that this was contrary to U.S. national security and foreign policy interests. Beijing, on 5th of February, blasted the Pentagon's decision to shoot down the balloon spotted flying over North America, charging the United States of clearly overreacting and seriously violating international practice. The website of the Global Times has also covered the story and tells us more. Chinese Foreign Ministry has urged the United States to stop abusing long-arm jurisdiction and unilateral sanctions which have distorted multilateralism and weakened international trade. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Mao Ning, said at a news conference, "The U.S.'s long-arm jurisdiction is an arbitrary judicial practice wielded by the U.S. government on the strength of its national power and financial hegemony to enforce extraterritorial jurisdiction over entities and individuals of other countries on the ground of its domestic law." The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said, "In order to maintain its leading position in economics, science and technology, the United States has disrupted normal trade and industrial chains and global supply by overdeveloping the concept of national security and abusing export controls." The spokesman went on to say, "Successive U.S. governments have resorted to economic coercion and made imposing sanctions their first choice when it comes to solving diplomatic issues." According to the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson, more than 9,400 U.S. sanctions were in effect by the end of 2021 fiscal year, and Washington has exercised long-arm jurisdiction over a number of countries, including China, Russia, Iran, Syria, and North Korea. She said, "Not only have they failed to achieve desired effects, but these sanctions have caused humanitarian disasters." Mao Ning expressed China's strong dissatisfaction and firm opposition to a resolution the U.S. House of Representatives adopted recently, condemning China for the unintended entry into U.S. airspace by a civilian Chinese airship. She said, "The resolution is purely political manipulation and hype." Mao Ning added, "The Chinese side has repeatedly presented its explanations regarding the unexpected accident involving the airship and said the accident occurred due to force majeure." Agence France-Presse has also covered the same story and tells us more. A U.S. Department of Defense spokesman said recently Beijing rejected a request for a secure call between Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin and his counterpart on the day of an American warplane shot down a suspected Chinese surveillance balloon. Referring to the People's Republic of China, Brigadier General Pat Ryder said in a statement on Saturday, 4th of February, immediately after taking action to down the People's Republic of China balloon, the Department of Defense submitted a request for a secure call between the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, and the People's Republic of China's Minister for National Defense, Wai Feng. Ryder added, "Unfortunately, the People's Republic of China has declined our request. Our commitment to open lines of communication will continue." China says the balloon was an errant weather observation aircraft with no military purpose, but Washington has described it as a sophisticated high-altitude spying vehicle. After slowly traversing the middle of the United States, reportedly over several top-secret military sites, the balloon headed out over the East Coast, where a fighter plane shot it down on Saturday. The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and the Chinese Defense Minister Wei Fei met in Cambodia last November as Washington and Beijing sought to lower the temperature after a visit by then-Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi that enraged China. But the balloon incident has heightened tensions between Beijing and Washington and led U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to scrap a rare trip to Beijing. On Monday, President Joe Biden defended a decision to wait until the balloon had crossed the country to down it, saying the Defense Department concluded that it was best to do so over water. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby claimed the same day that measures were taken to ensure the balloon's instruments were mitigated in their ability to spy during the flyover, while at the same time increasing and improving our ability to collect intelligence and information from it.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Russia is calling for an emergency meeting to be held by NATO regarding the September 26, 2022 explosions of the Nord Stream gas pipelines. Now, this after renowned American journalist Seymour Hersh has written that the United States is responsible for the explosions. Now, he said that U.S. President Joe Biden gave the order and the American Navy divers put explosives on the pipelines under the cover of NATO war games held in the region. Now, even though this information is quite explosive, mainstream media is either ignoring the bombshell altogether or downplaying it But the ramifications of this revelation may play a major role or the restructuring of the unipolar world. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst out of Brussels. And Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst out of Raleigh, North Carolina.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me on the program. I'll start this off with Gilbert out of Brussels. Your assessment of Hirsch's revelation, I mean, do you think that his accusations will be followed up by American officials or journalists?
Well, my personal opinion here is not a great consequence. I would like to use this opportunity to confirm that I have received today from two sources who are authoritative, very respectable, and well informed about the career of Seymour Hersh, who have written to me and to others that they have great confidence in the veracity and in the comprehensive truths that Hersh has presented on his website a couple of days ago. One of these is a retired U.S. diplomat with a distinguished career, who was in his later posts the ambassador to one of the major countries in the Middle East. He has confirmed the to me and to several others the integrity of Hirsch, his understanding that Hirsch's exposés of various abuses by the U.S. government going back decades were always well-founded and well-presented, and that Hirsch has been the vehicle for bringing these abuses to the public precisely because those who divulged what they knew, and these are people in the administration of Joe Biden, they understood his ability to protect his sources and the persuasiveness and authority that he would bring to the publication of these materials. The second confirmation comes from an equally authoritative and valuable source from a different field completely. That is a professor of law at the University of Illinois who wrote to me that going back to 1969, he was greatly impressed by Hirsch's exposés on the U.S. biological warfare programs. The man involved, the lawyer involved, is himself became the drafter of the implementation legislation that was introduced and passed in Congress in 1989-1990, implementing the General Convention on prohibiting biological weapons. So his personal experience and knowledge of Hirsch going back to 1969 was later confirmed by many other exposés, the My Lai massacre and the Abu Ghraib torture to span several decades of investigative reporting which were signed by Seymour Hersh. For these reasons, we welcome the Russian initiative to bring Hersh and other journalists material about this war crime to the attention of NATO and to other international institutions.
Okay. Stay with me, Gilbert. Let me get Ray in on this. Well, I mean, listening to what our guest in Brussels said, basically, he's saying that from what others are, people who are quite reputable are saying, that this is quite likely, quite possibly to be the truth. So, Ray, my question to you is, why aren't we seeing this bombshell explode in mainstream media and talking about this? This is a war crime. What's going on, Ray?
Well, I could profess to be shocked, but it's par for the course. And everything that Dr. Doctora has just said is true about Cy Hirsch. So despite all that, or actually because of his reputation for veracity and for protecting his sources, the U.S. media won't touch it in any real way. Now, it speaks volumes, and this is perhaps as equally important of the aspect of the story. Cy Hirsch wrote for the New York Times, got Pulitzer Prize, got five other kinds of Polk Awards, and then he wrote for the New Yorker magazine, and then he wrote for the New York Review of Books and the London Review of Books, and the last expose he had to write for Die Welt, a German newspaper whom he had a contact. Now he has to publish on his own Substack. My God, that speaks volumes. Now, the question is, will this Substack, and I know now that Hirsch's thing has been translated into German, will the Germans look at it, and will they download that clip which shows Olaf Scholz standing next to Joe Biden when Joe Biden says, we will end Nord Stream 2, and Scholz looks on, and he's asked, what about this? And he said, well, we do everything together. Together, we do everything. Will the German people ask Olaf Scholz now and his Bayerbock deputy, the foreign minister, will they ask him, did you do this together, Olaf? Or was this a surprise to you that the United States did it? Okay, the United States did it is a no-brainer, let's face it.
Right. Well, you know, you brought up an interesting point, Ray, about the Germans. Dr. I'd like to get your perspective on that, because, I mean, it's quite amazing in some ways when we look at the ramifications of all of this, what happened to begin with and how it has affected the Germans and other European countries. And, of course, basically officials being part of the American hegemony, just going along with it. Do you think that this will backfire? Do you think that the Europeans, at least if not Americans, but Europeans will actually demand some answers? Because Russia is demanding that NATO investigates this and hold those accountable, responsible. But your perspective on that?
I'm sitting in Belgium, and I was just looking today at our newspapers, surprised, again, in the sense that that Ray had it. There's not a word about Cy Hirsch. There's not a word about his expose of the explosions. So the European, and I look at the French newspapers, they are quiet. They are no more involved, no more forthcoming than American media. There's no surprise there either, because For years now, European newspapers and media have taken their cues from Washington, D.C. Still in all, there is hope that there's some slow glacial movement in Europe and even in Germany will bring attention to this. I was very pleased to see today that there is finally a left-right agreement in Germany between on the Linke with their leader Sacher Wagenknecht and with representatives of the Alternative for Deutschland to issue a manifesto for peace and to stage a demonstration at the Brandenburg Gate on the 25th of February, calling upon Chancellor Scholz to stop the shipments of heavy weapons to Ukraine, and instead to take an active role in calling for peace negotiations. This is a small chink in the ice, but it is worth noting and it has let us hope that more than a symbolic number of people turn out at Mandalay Gate.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Your overall assessment, I mean, we're seeing a full-out attack on Russia. I mean, the Nord Stream explosions, obviously, this is one part of it. We continue to see the NATO expansion towards Russia until basically Moscow had no choice but to deal with Ukraine in the way it is. Do you see everything that the United States and its allies that have done basically has now backed itself in the corner? Because it seems like, I mean, with the economic sanctions that they have targeted Moscow with, basically, Russia is back to where it was at the start of the war when we look at it from an economic perspective, and starting to expand other relations. I mean, your overall assessment of this, has the U.S. backed itself in the corner?
Well, the U.S. has isolated itself. You talked earlier on, or you mentioned the bipolar or the multipolar world was your phrase. I see it as bipolar, not only in the psychiatric sense, but in the realpolitik sense. It's the lily white West against people of color who represent 80% of the rest of the world and Russia. Russia has been blackened to the point where it's people of color as well. So what we have is a new correlation of forces. The problem is that the people who are running U.S. foreign policy are from the elite schools where they learn that the U.S. is exceptional. Now, they believe that. I mean, they think that the U.S. can just throw its weight around. This started 2 years ago when the U.S., when Blinken and Sullivan read the Riot Act to China, saying you got to obey the new rules-based order that we make the rules on. And it's continued right down the problem is that we all know what's going to happen in the next couple of months. I'm convinced that Russia is going to move as far west as they will without some indication of real bona fide negotiations on part of the U.S. in Ukraine, I'm talking, of course. And then the decision will be, well, were we wrong? Are we no longer exceptional? Or do we have to raise the ante still more and threaten the use, God forbid, of nuclear weapons? Nuclear weapons will not be a threat from the Russians. They don't need them in Ukraine. We will have people arguing that, yeah, maybe just a little tactical nuclear weapon might come in handy at this point. That's the danger.
Mm. Well, we look at, Dr. Rowe, also Russian expansion. We look at its influence over more and more African countries, where it seems that the U.S. and its allies are losing more and more of its influence, whether we're talking about Northern Africa, South Africa, Mali, Burkina Faso. Tell me, how do you see this, assess all of this, that more and more countries are leaning towards the big bear than the stars and stripe, and Washington's reaction to all of this?
Well, it's more than just Russian initiative. It's an American withdrawal. The two things have gone hand in hand. Yes, the Russians have been very keen to sign up more and more countries to at least abstain and hopefully vote their way in various contentious votes in the United Nations and in other global fora. They have had a lot of success. Some of this is maybe attributed to the remarkable successes of the Wagner private military company, which has been working in precisely the areas that you've just mentioned, and has proven itself to be a more valuable ally to the governments in holding peace than the French or other former colonial powers who have been displaced by the Russian entry. But I think we're really, first of all, looking at nose counting. Secondly, we're looking at the Russians changing their foreign policy from what it had been in the Soviet period. I was present a few years ago at a meeting in Moscow of parliamentarians, to which a number of African countries had been invited. And the head of the Communist Party of the Russian Federation was present at this reception and party, and it was glowing, as if the good old days of the Soviet Union were coming back. No, they're not coming back. The Russian Federation is a very different entity with a very different set of principles for governing very efficiently and for managing foreign policy in a way that is not that is constructive and not destructive of Russia's finances. In the past, Russia had given out a lot of financial aid and military aid and received little or nothing back. That's the Soviet period. That's gone. The Russians are playing an American game now in making foreign policy a contributor to their net wealth rather than a loss of their net wealth. And this pertains to their activities in Africa, where they have been very keenly tying in military support and like the Wagner Group with contracts that they conclude in the mineral extraction industries and other wealth of these countries that formerly was in the hands of the colonial overlords.
Well, Ray, we also see expansion with Russia with these various alliances they have, such as BRICS or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and these countries involved in that, and also looking for alternative banking system, international system. Your assessment of that, and where do you think this is going?
Well, the bilateral agreements now between Russia and China, Russia and Iran, Russia and many other countries sound the death knell for the primacy of the dollar in international trade. Again, the economists advising Biden don't seem to be any brighter than the ones advising him on foreign policy. So that's the big change. I would say that China has to be emphasized here because there has been a tectonic change in what the Russians used to call the world correlation of forces, and that is that we have Russia and China now in a virtual alliance which has no upper end, read military alliance if it comes to that. That's a marked change. And mark my words, that if there's a dust-up, if there's a armed conflict in Europe involving Russia and the West, you can expect lots of trouble, armed trouble, in the South China or the East China Sea or maybe even the Taiwan Straits. Now, that's what the U.S. policymakers, bright as they pretend to be, have gotten the U.S. into, and it's a no-win situation. You just don't go two against one, and the one is the United States now, and it's got the short end of this isosceles triangle.
What does that mean, Dr. You heard Ray McGovern say about the alliance, growing alliance between China and Russia. As he talked about the advisors to Biden, what is it? Is it the fact that the United States cannot accept a multipolar world, them not being on top, or if they can't lead, they don't care if the whole thing is destroyed? I mean, your assessment of this, obviously there should be some people advising against what they're doing.
Well, people who are advising against what they're doing are like Ray and myself, in dissident status outside the inner circles of power. I think you've rightly touched on the de-dollarization as one of the most significant developments in the last year. And the wars are measured by tanks and men on the ground and artillery pieces. That is a traditional and very easy to understand aspect of war. But since the very beginning of the Russian special military operation, when the United States froze, or shall we say confiscated, $350 billion of Russian reserves, the economic dimension of the war has been hard to miss. And that pertains to all aspects. The well-known doyen of the realist school of foreign relations in the United States, John Mearsheimer, was saying maybe 6 months ago, that explaining what the overall situation was in this conflict, that for Russia, the war is an existential war for its existence, whereas for the United States, this was an optional war that it could walk away from at any time. I have just read an analysis, which I found very persuasive, from a French historian, arguing that the war is now existential for the United States as well, precisely because the American means of maintaining its global hegemony, the financial weaponization of the dollar as a reserve currency, has been put in jeopardy. And if the Russians win on the ground, which appears to be the case, the Russians are also winning on the financial dimension in combination with Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, India, Iran, and China. It's not just China. There is a whole constellation of countries that have joined the United States, joined Russia, rather, quite willingly in a de-dollarization move.
Okay.
And that is in the most important commodity on earth.
All right. And on that note, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. I appreciate it. Very interesting discussion from both of you. Out of Brussels, Dr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, and out of Raleigh, North Carolina, former CIA analyst, Mr. Ray McGovern. A pleasure having both of you. And with that, that brings us to the end of this spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.